This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Der Handel an den Finanzmärkten kann eine einsame Angelegenheit sein. Wenn Sie also wissen möchten, wie man den Dunkelmodus auf Ihrer Plattform aktiviert oder wie Sie auf Ihr Konto einzahlen können, dann ist es gut, wenn Sie mit einem echten Menschen sprechen. Bei Capital.com sprechen unsere Teams Deutsch, Französisch, Italienisch, Spanisch und viele andere Sprachen. Setzen Sie sich mit uns in Verbindung und wir helfen Ihnen gerne bei der Beantwortung Ihrer Fragen zum Thema Trading. Capital.com. Entdecken Sie einen Broker, der Ihre Sprache spricht. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. And we begin here in London, where the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, is hosting a meeting of European leaders to chart a way forward on ending the conflict in Ukraine while maintaining the support of the United States. President Trump has begun unilateral negotiations with Russia to the exclusion of Ukraine and Europe, and has been refusing to offer any US security guarantees to deter further Russian aggression in the event of an agreement, saying that's up to Europe. Mr. Trump also sees President Zelensky as an obstacle to the kind of agreement he's seeking with Russia, and a meeting between the two men at the White House on Friday descended into a bad-tempered shouting match. Sir Keir Starmer had been at the White House earlier in the week for a more cordial meeting, so my colleague Laura Kunzberg asked him what he'd said to President Trump when he spoke to him about that meltdown in the Oval Office.
But I spoke to President Trump, I spoke to President Zelensky. Obviously, we then had President Zelensky to Downing Street yesterday, and I spoke to President Macron after that, and then to President Trump. And the purpose, or my driving purpose, has been to bridge this, if you like, and get us back to the central focus. And as a result of the meeting yesterday, we had quite a long time with President Zelensky, then President Macron and President Trump on the phone. We've now agreed that the United Kingdom, along with France and possibly one or two others, will work with Ukraine on a plan to stop the fighting, and then we'll discuss that plan with the United States. So in those calls on Friday night, through the meeting yesterday, into the calls again last night, I think we've got a step in the right direction.
But what happens matters so much, because it's about the trust and the relationship between the two men at the centre of this, President Zelensky and President Trump. President Trump said it's difficult to do business like this. He made it completely clear that he didn't have, in that moment, very much sympathy for Ukraine. He was berating President Zelensky, telling him he should be grateful. And I think, Prime Minister, anyone who's known you for a long time would have a pretty good guess that you would have felt deeply uncomfortable watching what played out, did you?
Yes, I felt uncomfortable. Nobody wants to see that. But the important thing is how to react to that. My reaction was, we have to bridge this. We have to find a way that we can all work together, because in the end, we've had 3 years of bloody conflict now. We need to get to that lasting peace. And I have to say, I've spoken to President Trump a number of times. I've met him twice. We had a long session on Thursday. I'm clear in my mind that he does want lasting peace. He does want an end to the fighting in Ukraine. I'm absolutely clear that's what his motive is. I agree with that. President Zelensky agrees with that. I think everybody agrees with that, apart from Putin. And in the end, that remains the central, most important thing, which is why we took a step forward, in my view, last night when we agreed that we would work on a plan for stopping the fighting and then, as it were, discuss that plan with the United States. That's a step forward from where we were on Friday, and an important step forward.
Do you think that President Zelensky has done anything wrong?
No, I think this is a man whose country has been at war for 3 years. They have been invaded by Russia. This is Russian aggression. I remember when the Berlin Wall came down as a young man, I thought that I'd never see Russian troops go over a border in Europe again. I thought we'd moved on to a new era. So when that happened, it's clear it's Russian aggression. And the quickest way to end this conflict is Russia to stop the aggression. And we need to be really clear about that.
Part of whether that's possible is whether the leaders who have to come to the table can trust each other. Now, you've said that Zelensky's done nothing wrong. One of the concerns that he was expressing in the Oval Office is that it's hard to trust Vladimir Putin's word. Would you trust Putin?
Well, no, I wouldn't trust Putin, which is why I want a security guarantee. I wouldn't trust him not to come again, because he's proven that he will come again. He's already done it. And we know what his ambitions are. That is precisely why we need a guarantee to the deal. There's no point in a deal that falls apart after a number of months or years. And therefore, the guarantee is because I believe there's a risk that Putin will come again if he's given the opportunity to do so. And I think we need to shut that opportunity out, which is why I've been so centrally focused on what a guarantee is. How do we defend the line if a line is agreed in the deal?
The British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer speaking to the BBC's Laura Kunzberg. Well, somewhat surprisingly, the Baltic states of Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia have not been invited to the London summit. Surprising because all three are members of NATO and the European Union, and two of them share a border with Russia. They're also, relative to their size, among the biggest supporters of Ukraine, arming and funding its military. Just before we came on air, I spoke to Marko Mikkelson, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Estonian Parliament. How does he feel about the fact that the Baltic nations have been excluded from the London summit?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something what we have already signaled back to London as well. And as far as I understand, if there will be any next meeting, the representatives, prime ministers from Baltic states will be present. As far as I know, our prime minister had a call to Prime Minister Starmer. There were discussion about what are the main ideas of today's meeting in London. And this is okay. But certainly when we see what is happening right now in our close neighborhood, and if at the time when political leaders here and there in Europe are constantly repeating that if Ukraine will fail or if we will fail in Ukraine, then the Baltic nations could be in danger, then it's obvious that our representatives, our politicians should be around those tables as well.
You mentioned that telephone call, and Sir Keir Starmer made that apparently to the leaders of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania and updated them on his discussions and underlined his focus on securing a lasting peace in Ukraine that ensures their future sovereignty backed up by strong security guarantees. You'd go along with that, would you?
Yes, I go along, obviously, with that. But the best security guarantee for Europe, for all of us, which is going to be in a connection with just peace and lasting peace, is that Ukraine must win in this war, win in peace, let's say, or win peace, because at this particular moment, and what did we witness also last Friday in Washington, unfortunately, Russia is setting the tone at the moment, and this is obvious reason why Ukraine is refusing to accept those terms.
Underlying your fears, I wondered, obviously your primary concern is for Ukraine, but in the longer term, do you feel that the prospect of a Russian invasion of the Baltic states is now closer than it was?
We have to be very sober and frank here, because Russia has not changed their strategic aims and goals. And this is not only to destroy Ukraine's statehood or sovereignty, as we know it, but also to destroy European security architecture, including testing perhaps also our resolve, Article 5's resolve. And, you know, there is no question that which areas and which directions they might test on. What is most important right now, and this is why this meeting in London today is also important, to show unity. This is something what really matters for Russians. That if Western alliance still matters, if we can speak in one voice, then win peace, which is just and lasting, then is obviously our security and our security of our alliance in much better shape.
Marko Mikkelson, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Estonian Parliament, and with me now, Keir Giles, an expert in Russian power projection at the British think tank Chatham House. And Mr. Giles, whatever you may think of Mr. Trump and his going it alone with Russia, he certainly concentrated the minds of the Europeans.
That's absolutely right. But we should bear in mind that this is not the first warning that Europe has had by a long chalk. It's not even the first warning that they've had before Trump. Time and again, we've seen these alarm calls being sounded and the reality of Europe's dependence on the United States being thrust in the faces of European leaders. Then there's a diplomatic scramble of the kind that we're seeing today. But the actual forward action towards addressing the problem seems to be ever so slow and forthcoming. So now that the crisis has been ignored for so long, it's turned into an emergency. We have to hope that this summit is actually going to bring some positive steps for addressing the situation that Europe finds itself in, both trying to build bridges with the United States, or rather rebuild them after they've been so spectacularly burned, but also facing the prospect of dealing with the security of the continent without the United States on side. And that is going to take a lot of extremely complex contingency planning.
So what does Europe therefore need to do? I mean, we've heard these constant refrains about spending more on defence. Is that in itself going to be enough?
The trouble is the spending, and in particular the ongoing endless debate about the percentage of GDP that is spent, is distracting from the real problem, which is the lack of what that spending is buying. It's the output of defense readiness that is missing. And for all of the ongoing complaints about the fact that defense has not been funded, the real question and the immediate question is what Europe can move with. If there is to be an attempt to uphold a peace in Ukraine and to make it a durable peace, a lasting peace of the kind we've heard about, rather than a temporary ceasefire, which is swiftly going to be broken by Vladimir Putin, that means European countries putting in place military force. And we've heard Keir Starmer repeatedly saying it can't be done without a US backstop. We've also heard the United States repeatedly saying that no such backstop is to be forthcoming. So that's got to be what's focusing the minds of people in this summit now. What exactly can Europe do, and how swiftly can they do it?
The Italian Prime Minister has called for a US-EU summit. We also have this talk of preparing a European peace plan. I just wonder whether there will be a coming together in the coming weeks, coming months.
Well, a European peace plan is long overdue. And of course, in some ways, this is precisely what the United States has been asking for so long. And in other ways, of course, it is the opposite of what the United States wants, because we've heard very clearly from the new US administration that their preferred outcome is the same as Russia's preferred outcome. Effectively, the surrender of Ukraine and the imposition of all Russia's demands, already preemptively ceded by the US administration before any peace talks begin. Now, the problem is, that's completely incompatible with the long-term future security of Europe. As we heard from Marco Mikkelsen just a few minutes ago, it's understood very clearly in the frontline states that the defense of Ukraine and the future safety of Ukraine is critical to the rest of NATO and those other countries of Europe bordering Russia. So there's a fundamental divergence of interest, it seems, between the US and Europe, even before you get into these arguments of who's going to pay for anything.
Mr. Giles, many thanks. That was Keir Giles, author of the book Who Will Defend Europe? An Awakened Russia and a Sleeping Continent. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, the project in Spain to restore the family photographs damaged in the Valencia floods.
Normally, people came with hundreds of them, but this man only had one. It was the only photograph he had of his father, who died when he was 5 years old. He had lost everything because of the flood, everything. And the photograph was the only thing that he had left. So you can imagine the pressure on us, the big responsibility.
And the top story is from the BBC newsroom. European leaders are gathering for a summit in London about Ukraine after Friday's row between Presidents Trump and Zelensky fueled anxiety about dwindling US support for Kyiv. And Israel has stopped all humanitarian aid from entering Gaza in a dispute over extending the first phase of the ceasefire there. Hamas has condemned the move. More details later in the programme. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. Back in the late 1940s and early 50s, in what was then the Belgian Congo, thousands of mixed-race children were forcibly taken from their families and placed in Catholic institutions. Decades later, five women, now elderly, took the former colonial power Belgium to court, seeking justice for themselves and many others. The BBC's Kane Pierre spoke to one of them.
In June 1960, Congolese people take to the streets, singing a song of hard-won independence. Before then, large parts of today's Rwanda, Burundi, and the Democratic Republic of Congo were under Belgian colonial rule. It was during that time that one day, Belgian soldiers enter a village and forcibly remove a four-year-old girl from her family.
Je suis Marie-Josée Lochy.
My name is Marie-Josée Lochy. I am Métis, mixed race. When they stole me from my mother, I felt lost. I was crying. I was abducted from my mother and dropped off among strangers who didn't even speak my language.
Marie-Josée Lochy is now 76 years old. And her story is not a one-off. Under colonial rule, Belgian officers stormed villages, seizing children with mixed-race heritage whom authorities saw as a threat to the colonial state.
So we have to maintain...
Bambi Koopmans is a senior researcher at the Royal Museum of Central Africa in Belgium. So
every single mixed-race child was seen as... Well, it literally showed that racial segregation could not be maintained. It was racist, it was gendered, so it was taken for granted that the children would identify with their white father because he was superior to their black mother.
Marie-Josée spent her childhood in a Catholic institute, 600 kilometres away from her family.
With independence coming so suddenly after 80 years of Belgian rule, the Congolese are furiously divided.
As more African countries gained independence in the early 1960s, so did Marie-Josée and the friends she had made at the Institute. Some chose to stay in the newly emancipated Congo, while others sought refuge from the conflict that ensued during the country's struggle for independence. Marie-Josée ended up in France after she was denied Belgian citizenship. But in 2021, she and four other women who suffered the same treatment launched a legal case against the government of Belgium, accusing it of kidnapping and racial persecution. Michel Hirsch is their lawyer.
The first thing that motivated me to help them was the courage of these women. For the first time, they were breaking their silence. Even their own children had never heard of this story. By speaking out, they believed they could prevent the repetition of a trauma.
La répétition d'un traumatisme.
During the first trial, the judges said that too much time had passed since the alleged crimes were committed. But the women appealed the court's decision, and on December 2, 2024, they were summoned to their lawyer's office to face the verdict.
J'ai eu très chaud puisque...
We didn't know what to expect. I remember feeling really hot and nervous. That's when Madame Isha's phone rang and we were told we had won. It was a miracle.
A miracle.
The state of Belgium was found guilty of crimes against humanity during colonial rule, a historic verdict that Michel Hirsch believes could lead to further reparations.
This is a victory for colonized people everywhere. This sets a precedent not just for Belgium, but potentially for former colonial powers worldwide.
Colonisateur que la Belgique.
The court has ordered the state to pay all five women 50,000 euros as compensation. But for them and their families, the money really doesn't matter.
Even after this historic ruling and such a long fight, we are wounded for life. We can never recover what we have lost, our youth, our childhood. We now have proof that justice exists.
Enfin compris que la justice existe.
Marie-Josée Lochy ending that report from Kane Pierre. Further evidence today of the commercialisation of space, once the domain of the superpowers. Private spacecraft has landed on the moon, only the second to do so. The touchdown of Blue Ghost was greeted with cheers from the control base of the American company behind the mission, Firefly.
Three contact sensors tripped.
Engine shutdown confirmed.
Power's nominal vehicle is charging.
IMU reports lunar gravity and it is stable.
Al Khan, chief engineer on ops. Y'all stuck to landing. We're on the moon.
And in the coming weeks, the vehicle hopes to explore the Sea of Crises, a huge crater visible from Earth. I'm joined live now by Dr. Megan Argo, senior lecturer in astrophysics at the University of Central Lancashire in the northwest of England. And this is a fairly straightforward exploratory mission, is it?
It is. This is part of NASA's commercial lunar package program. So this is part of the wider Artemis effort to try and get humans back to the moon within the next sort of decade or so. And what NASA have done here is they're trying to essentially outsource the transport of small lunar pieces of equipment and experiments to the moon without NASA having to take care of the launches and operations. So they provide contracts to companies basically for a fixed price, get this package to the moon for us and operate it and send us back the data. And this is another one in the series of missions. There have been several that have attempted so far. Not all of them have been successful. But as you say, this is the second one that's actually managed to successfully land on the moon. By all accounts, it's more successful than the first one, which had a problem on landing and ended up landing on a significant angle, which meant the solar panels couldn't charge the batteries terribly well. So this one has landed exactly where they expected it to and exactly the orientation they expected it to, so has been very successful.
And is the future, would you think, now of space exploration, these commercial partnerships?
I think, yeah, part of the reason for NASA going down this route for the Artemis support missions is to try and stimulate more of a space economy and get more commercial companies to the point where it becomes financially viable for them to send missions to the moon. And that certainly seems to be working. There are more and more small startup companies now looking at doing both launches, lunar landers, but Earth operations as well. And it's all sort of stimulating this economy.
But these commercial companies couldn't do it on their own.
They may get to the point where they're going to do it on their own. I think at the moment it requires the sort of funding, the contracts to come from the likes of NASA. But there are other companies that out there that are looking to try and do resource exploitation on the moon. And if they have the money to pay for these contracts and these operators prove that they can do it, then that will further stimulate the economy and take it more away from the big state operators.
Is there a downside at all to this commercial input into space exploration?
Well, I think as a scientist, there's sort of two ways to look at this. One, it means that we can get equipment to the moon more cheaply so that we can potentially do more science up there. But the downside is that potentially the kind of region that some of these missions are going to, a lot of these permanently shadowed craters near the South Pole, they are difficult to get to and they contain primordial water samples, so stuff left over from the early days of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago. And they're the only place we can find these that are close to the Earth. And analysing those can tell us a lot about the history of our solar system, how it came to be the way we see it today. If these commercial companies go up there to exploit those resources, they potentially destroy the ability for us to do that science and actually analyse those chemicals in their pristine form as they currently are. So there are risks and benefits to doing this.
Dr. Argo, many thanks. That was Dr. Megan Argo, senior lecturer in astrophysics at the University of Central Lancashire in the northwest of England. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes. You're with NewsHour. And the Academy Awards, or Oscars, are about to take place in Los Angeles later today, and the race for Best Film is wide open. The city is still recovering from last month's wildfires, but the awards season has continued. The musical Wicked is up for Best Picture, along with the papal election thriller Conclave, while the exotic dancers from the cast of Anora are also getting ready to appear on the red carpet, as Emma Vardy now reports.
Hi, I'm Annie.
You don't have cash. Let's go to the ATM.
Anora, the film about a lap dancer who marries a Russian oligarch, has emerged as one of the frontrunners for Best Picture, and its star, Mikey Madison, could take Best Actress over more established stars Demi Moore and Fernando Torres.
Okay, so who should marry?
Anora's director, Sean Baker, cast real exotic dancers in the film, including actor and dancer Lindsay Normington, who was already famous in LA for organising a labour union of strippers.
there's going to be some real strippers at the Oscars. So I hope that that's exciting for someone out there to see a few of us proudly. It's a foot in both worlds. It's amazing.
In terms of the film's chances, I mean, some people calling it the front runner, but it's also quite polarizing.
Yeah.
Because, like you say, because of some of the subject matter and the way that that's told on screen, what do you think about the kind of reaction to it and the way that it has polarized opinion?
I think it's great. I think this is something that's really going on in the world. We are a community that faces so much stigma and backlash.
The supervision of this election is a duty I never thought I'd have to perform.
Ralph Fiennes is in contention for Best Actor in Conclave, which lifts the lid on the secretive process for choosing a new pope, and is also up for Best Picture. So making it onto this red carpet as a nominee is a huge mark of respect from the movie-making industry.
It's vengeance most foul!
Wallace and Gromit are no strangers to Hollywood now, and are back with their sixth Oscar nomination. Creator Nick Park is here, this time with his co-director Merlin Crossingham.
What sort of doors does that open if you actually come home holding a trophy?
Gosh, I'm waiting to find out. It's my first time.
Yeah. It's worked well for me. But I mean, I think it's more the kudos, really. Because you don't think about it day to day.
And what do you put the success down to this year? What was the magic ingredient, do you think?
Oh, it's all about just telling a good story, really. Yeah.
The story is contemporary. It's looking at the relationship of technology in the world and how much we need it, how much it benefits us. And it's not anti-tech at all. It's very pro-tech as an idea. But just looking at that balance, you know, how does it sit in our lives? And that's very pertinent in the day-to-day. Popular.
I know about popular. Oh, I saved you some space, by the way.
Do you really think this is fair?
Dreams come true at the Oscars as filmmaking history is written. And without an out-and-out favourite for Best Picture this year, it promises to be a night where anything can happen.
Emma Vardy reporting. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Now, is the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, which came into effect on January the 19th, in danger of unravelling? The first phase of that deal, which has resulted in the release of dozens of Israeli hostages and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, expired yesterday. Israel, though, has accepted a US proposal for a six-week extension of that first phase. But Hamas has rejected the proposal, keen to move on to the second phase, which would involve the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. So now there's a standoff, with each side pressurising the other. Last night, Hamas released a distressing hostage video, while Israel has since stopped all humanitarian aid from entering Gaza. Let's hear first from the BBC's Paul Adams, who joins us now from Jerusalem. And Paul, have I got it roundabout right with that introduction?
I would say that's an extremely effective and precise explanation of where we are right now, Julian. We are in a state of deadlock with two very, very different views on how this should proceed. The very real prospect that things could unravel. But I think a great deal of pressure being exerted behind the scenes, almost certainly mostly on Hamas, to agree to some kind of extension which would see more hostages coming out, more Palestinian prisoners being released, but crucially, no start of an Israeli military withdrawal from Gaza.
Was it always envisaged in that second phase that hostage releases, Palestinian prisoner releases would continue?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, we're supposed to see the release of all the remaining living hostages, that thought to number 24 during this second phase, which would leave only deceased hostages to be released in the third phase. And yes, there was to have been the release of hundreds more Palestinian prisoners too. You know, Israel, people on both sides have gotten used over the past 6 weeks to the gradual release of hostages and prisoners. They've come to expect it and they desperately want it. So there is going to be huge frustration, I think, on both sides if this whole arrangement sort of now grinds to a halt. And I think it's clear that that the Americans are siding with Israel in terms of a need for some kind of extension. Stephen Witkoff, the U.S. envoy, special envoy, was supposed to come here to try and oversee negotiations on some kind of extension. He hasn't yet scheduled a visit, which suggests to me that he doesn't think we are yet close enough to a new agreement being reached.
Paul, many thanks. That was the BBC's Paul Adams speaking there from Jerusalem. And on the line now, Boaz Bismuth, an Israeli member of parliament with the governing Likud party and chairman of the National Security Committee. Mr. Bismuth, why does Israel want this six?
Der Handel an den Finanzmärkten kann eine einsame Angelegenheit sein. Wenn Sie also wissen möchten, wie man den Dunkelmodus auf Ihrer Plattform aktiviert oder wie Sie auf Ihr Konto einzahlen können, dann ist es gut, wenn Sie mit einem echten Menschen sprechen. Bei Capital.com sprechen unsere Teams Deutsch, Französisch, Italienisch, Spanisch und viele andere Sprachen. Setzen Sie sich mit uns in Verbindung und wir helfen Ihnen gerne bei der Beantwortung Ihrer Fragen zum Thema Trading. Capital.com. Entdecken Sie einen Broker, der Ihre Sprache spricht. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Week extension of the first phase of the ceasefire agreement.
What Israel wants is to see all the hostages back. I mean, this is what Israel really wants. And in order to bring them back, as you know perfectly well, I mean, we had a deal and we would like to prolong it. I think that this would have been a great thing if we could have achieved it while we had the first deal, if you remember, on the 24th of November, 2023. And let's again not forget, I mean, when we speak of deals and the fact that we're dealing here with hostages that were taken in the massacre of 7th of October, and let's not forget that we're dealing here with a state, with Israel, versus a terrorist organization. Okay. And why am I saying that? Concerning the remark of your correspondent when he said that Israel has the USA support or Washington support or the Trump's administration, I would expect, or I would say, think that, I mean, we have the support of the free world, and including London, including yourself.
But why do you need to extend the first phase when, as I understand it, under the second phase, the release of hostages and Palestinian prisoners would continue?
You would agree, if I don't get into the details by themselves, because I would be the last one to want or in any way.
Well, I mean, will those releases continue under the second phase? Will they?
No, look, it's clear. I mean, you have to understand one thing. I mean, the objective, I mean, Israel, I mean, is the objective of Israel is to bring back all the hostages. I mean, those who are alive and those who are not alive. Right. And when you prolong, I mean, this first stage, as we say, in order, what is behind it? I mean, to bring back, of course, our hostages, which is something that all the world should support and put pressure over Hamas and the countries or states or any organization or any personality that has any connection directly or indirectly with them.
I just really have to be very clear on this, Mr. Bismuth. Would the release of hostages continue under the second phase? Why do you need to extend the first phase other than your impatience?
You have to understand one thing. Hamas have to understand one thing. I mean, Israel has Israel was very clear about our objectives after the massacre of the 7th of October. Sure. Things have to be clear. And the hostages have to be at home. I mean, they have to come out of Gaza, and the faster the better, because you saw, like me, all the world has seen the state in which they leave Gaza, and you saw the way they are being, how they're treated in the tunnels of Hamas.
You're trying to get the hostages out as fast as you can, even though the way in which you're trying to do it is a breach of the ceasefire agreement. You will acknowledge that.
Now, with all due respect, I mean, concerning your question, with all due respect, as I said again, what are we talking about? We're talking about the country who has hostages over there and a terrorist organization who slaughtered only last week. We saw two babies mutilated after their death. So let's put things, I mean, clear, because I think that people try to forget and see here, I mean, how would I say, look at it, I mean, as if we're dealing here with two states, I mean, who have a deal or an agreement. We're talking of terrorist organization and the country that wants its hostages back. Let's be clear about
okay.
it.
Okay, so Israel made a deal with a terrorist organization, as you describe it. But now what? You're having second thoughts and you've decided to breach that agreement? Is that what's going on here?
Sir, with all due respect, first of all, I would expect you also, by the way, to join me in the call of releasing all hostages.
Well, I'm sure that is what the world would wish.
I would only say that Israel, again, as I said, Israel today, what we are doing in our desire to prolong phase one is to bring the maximum of hostages. When I say maximum, I made a mistake. All the hostages, to bring them back, and more important than that, only yesterday you saw the video of the two brothers, so you saw with what sadist, what means, I mean, Hamas is using, and this is why they have to be out. The sooner, the better.
Okay, let me just put one final point to you. And that is that the reason that Israel does not want to move on to the second phase is that you are not prepared to contemplate, and maybe this is the government as a whole, maybe it is members of the government, but you're not prepared to contemplate the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. Is that right?
I'll be very clear concerning this point and saying one thing. I don't think that any friend of Israel in the world, whether in France, in the UK, in America, or in Canada, anyone who cares for Israel does not expect an organization like Hamas ruling a territory which has a border with Israel. And this is why Hamas have to know clearly, perfectly well. I mean, the hostages will be back, but Hamas will not stay in Gaza. This is clear.
Okay, so just very briefly to sum up, Mr. Bismuth, many thanks for your time. That was Boaz Bismuth, an Israeli member of parliament. After the devastating floods in the Spanish region of Valencia last year, students and volunteers are attempting to save precious memories. In the days following the disaster, which killed more than 220 people, a team from Valencia's Polytechnic University sifted through the wreckage for old family photos. They're now working painstakingly to restore what was damaged, and they've received thousands of photos from other survivors. Pedro Vicente is leading the project at the university. My colleague Paul Henley asked him whether he expected such a response.
When we started to do the project, we thought we were going to get, I don't know, maybe 10, 20, 30,000 photographs. But now we have got 280,000 photographs. So it was massive, the response that we got, because, well, there were those photographs that were damaged.
And a lot of people do say, don't they, that they're their most treasured possessions. When the house burns or the house floods, that's what they run to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when people who have lost everything, they hold on to memory, and photographs hold memory. So that's why it's so important, or family photographs. They say who we are, who we were, and probably who we are going to be. A few weeks ago, a man came to us with just one photograph, just one. Normally, people came with hundreds of them, but this man only had one. It was the only photograph he had of his father, who died when he was 5 years old. He had lost everything because of the flood, everything. And the photograph was the only thing that he had left. So you can imagine the pressure on us, the big responsibility, and incredibly moving and emotional to be able to clean that photograph and ultimately to save it.
Now, you're dealing with lots of soggy bits of paper that have been submerged for days, in some cases weeks. How do you go about restoring them?
Well, the first thing we do is we freeze them, because there's a lot of bacteria on the papers that are destroying, literally eating the paper. So if we can't intervene then immediately, we freeze them. And then when we restore actually the paper, we clean them with clean water, with several baths of clean water, around 10 baths. Very, very carefully, one photograph at a time, one by one, with some brushes, and trying to get out all the bacteria, all the mud they still have on the paper. And then we clean them, we scan them, because we also give a digital copy of all the photographs to the families, and then we mount them on clean piece of cardboard to give the family back, well, not the album as it was, but at least as close as it is possible to how it was.
And if you have lost some of the image, there's a role for artificial intelligence, I hear.
Yes, we are starting now with this second stage of the project, in which we are trying to train artificial intelligence to restore digitally some of those photos. We are thinking that we could restore around 80, 90,000 photographs with this AI. The problem is to restore these images using Photoshop or any other program for retouching photographs is quite easy. It's not difficult. The problem that we have here are numbers. We have 80, 90,000 photographs that need to be digitally restored. And with the artificial intelligence, what we are trying to do is to automatize. So it will be much faster and quicker than if a human restores the image.
That was Dr. Pedro Vicente. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. 3 years of war have not crushed the creative industries in Ukraine, and a Ukrainian sci-fi film has been garlanding awards at international film festivals and will be shown at the Glasgow Film Festival next week. You Are the Universe is the first sci-fi movie to be made and filmed in Ukraine.
Ти серйозно? Це ж нормальна гра.
Можна я розкажу тобі анекдот?
Ні.
We hear a voice there saying your whole species has just vanished, and Andruka, you are the last human in the entire universe. Well, much of it was filmed before the full-scale Russian invasion in 2022, but it was completed during the conflict. It's the work of Ukrainian director Pavlo Ostrikov. He explained the film's plot to me.
It's a story about last love in the universe between two different people. The main plot is set on near future, and the main character is Andriy. He's the space tracker who needs to deliver nuclear waste from the Earth to the satellite of the Jupiter. During this trip, our Earth exploded. He became the last man in the universe. And when he realized it, he, of course, in some sort of depression. And then he received a message from the far, far away station. She's a French woman from the station. That's all, I guess. They start conversations, and basically it's a story about connection, love, and maybe friendship, I guess.
I was intrigued that Andriy seems to have a companion with him, a robot called Maxim.
In the start of my writing process, I realized that I need some companion for the Andriy, because we can't see anybody besides Andriy, and I need some dialogues in the spaceship. This robot told dead jokes. It's really a funny relationship.
I know that you began filming before Russia's invasion, but you had to complete the film after the war started, and that was challenging for you.
The whole movie, it was challenging for me, but the Russian invasion, it was, I guess, like a burden for us to make this film, because nobody cares for movies in that time. But we realized, I guess, in the summer of 2022 that we need to finish it. It was also our travel from the reality. We gathered the crew, but many members were serving in the army. For instance, our producer, the main character, the voice who act the robot, and also the editor. Many great people were serving in the army. But we managed to gather the crew and finish it.
I mean, I know that the film was started before the war. As I understand it, it hasn't been shown in Ukraine yet. But it'll offer people some form of escapism, won't it, I suppose, from the conflict, a film like this?
Unfortunately, yes, because we produced a film about the war, but for Ukrainians, it it's hard to watch it. But for Ukrainians, yes, we need some light movies, comedies to manage with reality. But unfortunately, we can't release in this spring, and we need to wait for the autumn.
By which time, maybe the conflict will be over. What do you think?
I don't know, because recent meetings with Trump in Ukraine, we just shocked, and we don't know what to do, what to think about it. We just try to focus on our lives and soldiers, just to defend our country.
Ukrainian film director Pavlo Ostrikov. Iran's parliament has sacked the country's finance minister, Abdul Nasir Hemati, shortly after beginning impeachment proceedings against him. They blame him for soaring inflation and a plummeting currency. Mr. Hemati had previously had the support of President Masoud Pezeshkian, who said that Iran's economic woes could not be blamed on one man. Paham Gobadi is a senior reporter with BBC Persian.
We are right before the Persian New Year, Nowruz, and Iranian people are suffering economically in an unprecedented manner. Inflation has been soaring. In the past 7 months that this new government has taken office, the Iranian currency has lost its value over 50%. And so the soaring inflation and the plunging value of Iranian currency has made the Iranian lawmakers impeach the Iranian finance minister. However, probably both parties, they know that the buck does not stop with him. And that's what the Iranian president, reformist president Masoud Pezeshkian, said in his speech in today's parliament in defense of his finance minister, that such major decisions in Iran is made by the head of different branches, like the government and the judiciary and the parliament. So Iranian finance minister has not that much of a power in this economy. And that's what the Iranian critics have been saying all along, that major decisions in Iran are made by the Iranian supreme leader. And Pezeshkian said that, you know, I was in favor of negotiating with the West, and that's how he managed to get the 50% of the vote. But he said that the Iranian supreme leader said that he banned the negotiations with the United States after Donald Trump took office. And so I stopped thinking about that.
I mean, the Iranian president says that the state of the Iranian economy cannot be blamed on one man, and that the country is fighting a war, a reference to these punitive US sanctions. And you are suggesting that his hands are tied with any kind of negotiations that he would want with the United States, with the West, to loosen those sanctions.
That's correct. And he mentioned Donald Trump. He said that Iran is in a state of war, economic warfare with the United States. He said that those countries that have good relations with Iran, such as Qatar, such as Turkey, such as Iraq, they are not giving our money back, the money they owe us. And he said that since Donald Trump has taken office and he signed that memorandum to exert a maximum pressure campaign again on Iran, Iranian tankers around the globe are in the seas, and they are not able to sell their oil or their gas. And what Donald Trump has promised is to make Iranians not be able to sell even a gallon of oil.
I mean, the president's come out in defense of the finance minister. Parliament, however, has voted to sack him by quite a large majority. This is a challenge, is it not, also to the president?
It is. It is. He also apologized to Iranian people, because you know that it's not only the economic situation in Iran that is in a dire state, but also Iranians have been suffering from other problems as well, such as the electricity has been getting caught all the time during the winter.
That was Parham Gobadi, a senior reporter with BBC Persian. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.